Hey everybody, it's Britt, lead pastor at Sunridge. Welcome back to our teaching podcast. You know, we are on a mission here at Sunridge to help people find and follow Jesus. We believe in the good news that Jesus welcomes all, regardless of how far you feel from God. That means we're a great starting point to explore Christianity or to sink your spiritual roots deep as a devoted Jesus follower. If you'd like to know more about us, just check out our website at sunridgechurch.org. And of course, we'd love to have you drop in anytime for a visit to learn and worship along with us. And now, here's our teaching for this week.
Good morning, Sunridge.
Good morning.
If you're new or if you've been here for 30 years, I wanted to say welcome. And this, you are here at Sunridge on Sunday morning. Even if you're joining us online, you're part of us. Hey, I don't know if you have seen the musical Hamilton before. Anybody seen it? Okay, that's awesome. If you've seen it, then first of all, you know, Lin-Manuel is a genius, right? Let's start off there. But if you're not familiar, Hamilton is a musical about the political beginnings of the United States. And in particular, it centers on one of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton. And one of the songs from the musical, The Room Where It Happens, centers on the character of Aaron Burr, who's jealous of the power and the influence that Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison and others wield. And so he feels frustrated because it seems like he's always on the outside looking in when all these crucial decisions are being made. And he sings in the song, I won't sing it, trust me, no one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens. And then he laments, I want to be in the room where it happens. The room where it happens. I want to be in the room where it happens. So being in the room where it happens, for Burr, is a turn of phrase that describes these backroom conversations. The room where it happens is where the deal gets done, and the powerful people get to say, what happens? Now, hopefully not all of us are in an ambitious struggle to be at the pinnacle of power in politics or even in the workplace. But most of us do grapple with this desire to control what happens, right, in our lives. And sometimes we can even maneuver to manipulate people to get them to do things our way. We're in a study, if you're just joining us, of John's gospel, and as Ron just read, this opening scene in John 12 describes a room where something happened. But it's quite different from the room that Aaron Burr wanted to be in. Rather than in 1790 colonial America, the room is in first century Bethany, a small town about 2 miles east from Jerusalem. It's not a smoky back room, but it's the home of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, possibly even Simon the leper as well. And what's happening is not powerful people forging secret deals from which the most powerful nation in the world is going to arise, but a humble follower of Jesus who will demonstrate the values of the kingdom of heaven. Today we're going to spend our time observing what happens in this room in first century Judea, along with two other events that happen in chapter 12. And then we're going to wrap it all up, as we always do, by asking the question, what does this mean for you and me today? So let's get started. In verses 1 through 11, Mary anoints Jesus. John tells us that it's less than a week before Passover, which is the celebration of Israel's escape from Egypt, their freedom, and Jesus comes to stay with Lazarus, Martha, and Mary in Bethany. And to honor Jesus, a dinner is held in his honor. And it says in verse 2, Martha serving, no surprise there, right? And while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. So Jesus and others are reclining at the table. In the first century, people would eat at a low table. And they didn't have chairs. They would lay on pillows, and they would kind of shoot their feet out sideways. And Lazarus is there. So remember, like, Lazarus was raised from the dead, you know, in chapter 11. Can you imagine what he's thinking when he's sitting there eating dinner? And it's like, man, this time last week I was dead. And here I'm eating dinner with Jesus. So this is the room where it will happen. But what happens? Verse 3, then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. So Mary, right, always the worshiper, she takes this fragrant liquid that the New Testament calls, it's nard. It's a powerful perfume that smelled like gladiolus. And it was used at that time in a variety of ways. It was used as medicine, a wine additive, a breath freshener, and perfume. And John says that it's pure, which is, it means it's very expensive perfume. Now, when I was a kid, for my mom on Mother's Day or birthday, I would buy her those big bottles of perfume. And she always acted like she really appreciated it. I'm sure it probably smelled like bug spray or something. But on special occasions, especially if my dad was involved, we would get my mom a small bottle of Chanel No. 5. Anybody remember Chanel No. 5? Okay, pure nard is Chanel No. 5. The fancy stuff, right? So Matthew and Mark say that they had that she poured it on Jesus' head and it trickled down over his body to his feet. And you've probably been in a social situation that became uncomfortable because someone did or said something unconventional. And so if you look at this scene and it seems weird to you, it is kind of weird. And it would have been uncomfortable at this time as well, because Mary breaks a lot of cultural norms in this act. First of all, as a Jewish woman in the first century, she's supposed to be in the kitchen serving with Martha. Secondly, this perfume would have been part of her dowry, so for when she gets married. So this kind of reduces her prospects for marriage. And a woman's long hair at this time was her crown and her glory. So using her hair to wipe Jesus' feet is so undignified. In fact, only a woman's husband was supposed to ever see a woman with her hair down, according to N.T. Wright. Here's a quote from his commentary. "This is roughly the equivalent at a modern polite dinner party of a woman hitching up a long skirt to the top of her thighs." So you can imagine how uncomfortable it is in the room. And by the way, Luke adds in his gospel that the woman involved here, Mary, was known to have been a sinner, which is likely to have been a prostitute. So imagine how that amplifies the discomfort of this woman, formerly a prostitute, although a friend of Jesus, is touching Jesus in doing this. And the people are shocked, but for different reasons. John indicates that Judas is the first to speak in verse 5. He's like, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." A year's wages. Not even Chanel No. 5 is that expensive. So this is an extravagant and lavish act by Mary. And remember, Judas is the one who's going to betray Jesus. And so he objects to the wastefulness, but is that really his concern? John has a side comment in verse 6. "He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As a keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it." In other words, Judas doesn't care about the poor or the impracticality of her act. He was just greedy and an embezzler. And Matthew and Mark even tell us in their gospel that it wasn't just Judas that piled on. We don't know what led Mary to this extravagance, but Jesus immediately comes to her defense and he praises her for her grasp on the gospel. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial." So what is that about? See, spices and perfumes were used to cover the odor of death in the first century. So this is an act of a pre-act by Mary in devotion to pre-prepare Jesus' body for his imminent death. And I can imagine that the fragrance of this perfume that is all over his body and his clothes to be fragrant during his trial and his torture and even his crucifixion. Then in verses 12 through 19, Jesus enters Jerusalem. And as Jesus and his disciples make their way from Bethany to Jerusalem, word spreads that Jesus is on his way, and they go out to meet him. In verse 13, they took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." So they're rolling out the red carpet for Jesus, only it's green, with palm fronds. And so it was customary at this time when to welcome a dignitary or a king, some military hero, to greet them at the outside of the city as they approached. And this arriving VIP would arrive with much pomp and circumstance, and they would have an entourage with them, and they would normally be riding on this magnificent horse. And Jesus downplays that in verse 14. Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it. And John tells us that all the people involved, particularly the disciples, they don't fully grasp what's happening right before their very eyes. But the Pharisees, remember the religious leaders who hate Jesus and they seek his life, they definitely know what time it is here. And they see that their standing in relation to the people is being eroded. In verse 19, so the Pharisees said to one another, "See, this is getting us nowhere. What we've been doing. Look how the whole world has gone after him." And as we mentioned before, the Pharisees constantly reveal this dark side of religion gone bad when motivation becomes so crass that your honored status and having a large following is more important to you than your moral integrity. And then in verses 20 through 36, Jesus speaks openly of his death. John explains that there were Greeks that probably non-Jewish believers who sought an audience with Jesus. And that seems to be a mile marker for Jesus' ministry, for him to expand his gospel outreach. Because at first he said that he came exclusively for the Jews. And now he is expanding his message to the wider world. Verse 23, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. So now he's revealing a bigger picture and more fully how inclusive John 3:16 actually is when he said, God so loves the world, right? And he illustrates this, the gospel, a few ways. One, from agriculture in verse 24, very truly I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. So Jesus is not only planting seeds of thought here in his audience, but he's saying the giving of his life will multiply into countless lives changing. He illustrates it from the Old Testament in verse 32, and he says, when I'm lifted up from the earth, I will draw all people to myself. And devout Jews would immediately get his reference to Numbers 21. The world would be rescued from the venomous sting of death by looking to the cross that Jesus would be lifted up on. And then he uses the daily rhythms of their lives in verse 36, believe in the light while you have the light, so that you may become children of light. So Jesus here uses the regular rhythm of their daily lives to express the urgency with which they should consider believing in him. In the first century, people didn't have the capacity to light their world 24/7. As we do, so there was a sense of urgency to get your work done while the sun is still up. And so Jesus is saying, don't procrastinate. Today is the day to seriously consider his claim to be the only Son of God, because no one is assured of tomorrow. And in verses 38 through 50, the people respond or not. First of all, there are those who don't believe in spite of everything Jesus has said and accomplished. In verse 37, even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. And then there are those who believe, but they're reluctant to publicly say so. In verse 42, yet at the same time, many, even among their leaders, believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they would not openly acknowledge their faith, for fear they would be put out of the synagogue. For they loved human praise more than the praise from God. So I don't know about you, but like, how many of you just feel, I mean, like, you find that statement particularly disturbing? The fear of good people to not speak up about their faith, not because of the secular response that would come from the Romans, but for fear of retaliation by those from within their own faith. So strange that religious leaders could become the obstacle to someone discovering Christ. And Jesus only wants them to see the truth in verse 46. I've come into the world as a light so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. And that pretty much wraps up our overview of chapter 12. And that's as far as we're going to go in John today. So what can we learn from this? What is there in John 12 that has the potential to affect us, our beliefs, and what our priorities are today? And that, for the conclusion of my time, I'm just going to note a few things. And I would say that chapters 12, of course, all of the book of John, but chapter 12 in particular, gives us a clearer picture of who Jesus is and what it means to walk in his ways. It puts me in mind of Philip Yancey's book, The Jesus I Never Knew. I highly recommend that book if you've never read it before. And in the first chapter, titled The Jesus I Thought I Knew, Yancey describes the many views of Jesus that he had been introduced to over the course of his life. He talks about beginning, as a child in Sunday school. It was kind of the European Jesus with the nice, straight, hippie hair and the sandals and cradling a little lamb in his arms. To the hippie Jesus freak Jesus of the 1960s. And in my conversion in the 70s as a high school student, I was introduced to the Baptist Jesus. Very different from the hippie Jesus, I might note. And our Jesus was, he had lots of rules against long hair on boys and girls wearing slacks and dancing and rock music and basically anything fun. And in my Bible college days, I was introduced to the moral majority Jesus, the one who could rescue us from the liberal agenda. And today, we're seeing the Christian nationalist Jesus. It's kind of crusade light, where we seek power and try to impose faith on people. But none of these capture the Jesus of the New Testament. So what does John 12 reveal about what it really means to follow the Jesus in the Bible? Number one, the way of Jesus is a life of worship. The way of Jesus is a life of worship. Mary anointed Jesus' feet with expensive perfume, a gesture that was both extravagant and personal. And worship can take many forms, so I don't think that John is telling us to bring our Chanel number 5. And I'm sure there's more bougie and expensive perfume today, but I don't know about it. Pour it on the altar here as an offering to Jesus. And it's also very unlikely that any of us would use our hair to wipe someone's feet, especially if some of us who are more follically challenged, it'd be more like sandpaper or something, I don't know. Maybe I could burr down those heels for you. I don't know about you, but this causes me to ask, do I really worship Jesus in my heart? Is the real Jesus in the Bible the object of my worship? And even what does it even look like today? In 2025, to have Jesus, to have my full devotion. We typically think that, worship is to sing and pray and gather together like we are here today, and it is that, but doesn't it essentially mean that we're giving our whole allegiance to Jesus? Jesus said in Mark 12:30 that we're to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind and all your strength. So is Jesus the sole object of my worship in that way? Or do I have lots of other idols and priorities that tend to push Jesus down the list? Are there things, if I'm being honest with myself, that really are more important to me than Jesus? Like myself, my time, my priorities, my interests. Does God get my leftovers, or does he get my very best? Or my worldview? Am I bending my perception of Jesus to accommodate my vision of the world and how I want things to be? You know, today I find myself in conversations with people, constantly pointing them, whether they come from the left or the right, pointing them to the Sermon on the Mount. Because I think that is Jesus' manifesto. And if we want to follow Jesus, let's go to that. And I encourage you to read the Sermon on the Mount regularly, because that's the Jesus who would be shaping us. How is my daily life an example of wholehearted worship? Whether I think about it like I'm a parent, or I'm a teacher, or an electrician, or a business owner. How am I worshiping God in the way that I do that? You know, Mary laid it all out there, no holds barred, and she leaves us an example of what it means to surrender every part of ourselves to worship Jesus. The way of Jesus is a life of worship. Number two, the way of Jesus is a life of sacrificial service. Sacrificial service. Jesus said in John 10:10, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. But by that, he didn't mean make sure you get all you can. The paradox of following Jesus is that we'll find our life by losing it, Jesus said. In other words, according to Jesus, true life is found in sacrificial service to others. Following Jesus isn't a life of power or dominance and self-centered interests. It's the opposite. In Mark 10:43, Jesus said, whoever wants to become great among you, you must become a servant. And he is our example, right, on how to do so. Jesus arrived on a donkey. Reflecting upon the great sacrifice that was imminent, his soul is troubled, and yet he offers up this conflicted prayer in John 12:27. Father, save me from this hour. No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Have you ever prayed a prayer like that? Like, I don't want to do this, God, but you're calling me to do this. In Jesus' prayer, he said, I recognize two things, the sacrifice of the calling that you've given me, and number two, my own willingness to go through it for the sake of others. Have you heard that saying, like priest, like people? You haven't? Like priest, like people. Like, people follow their leaders, their example. And what's interesting here is that when Jesus stands before Pilate, the people following the Pharisees shout for his crucifixion. Like priests, like people. Jesus' example is one of servant leadership and using our resources on behalf of others. More power to any of us who are ambitious and want to be in the room where it happens. But what happens in the room shouldn't be a power grab. It's an opportunity to serve others. If we want to follow Jesus, the real Jesus, it means to follow him in sacrificial service. In chapter 12, Jesus says this in verse 25, anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. So what does it mean to live a life of sacrificial service? Does it mean like I have to go like crucify myself or like just intentionally hurt myself? Of course not. If you're married, what does it look like for you to truly serve your husband or your wife, to put them before you in your relationship? What is it like to Like when you're given an opportunity to serve someone, do you take it? Who are your heroes? Are they people who just shout other people down? Or are they people that roll up their sleeves and try to make a difference? When you see a problem or a situation or an injustice or someone is struggling, is your gut response to say, how can I help? Following Jesus is a life of sacrificial service. Number three, the way of Jesus is a life guided by eternal perspective. Guided by eternal perspective. We're often tempted to view our lives through our successes and our defeats, or our immediate comfort, or our short-term goals. But hear these words from the Apostle Paul in Colossians 3:2. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. Jesus' death looked like a victory to some, a defeat to his followers. But in John, in verse 24 here, he says, very truly I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed, but if it dies, it produces many seeds. In other words, what we do today has long-term effects. I think one of the first teaching series that I did when I came here, I called Domino. And we had these big dominoes up here. And it was all about, like, you know, we showed videos every week of, like, you know, people that set up these elaborate domino things and they tip the first one over and, like, goes everywhere. And we just talked about how each one of us is a domino. And we tip ourselves into the thing that God has for us. Whatever that thing is. And we tip our domino over and over again. And every time we do that, we start a run of dominoes. What we do today affects many things in the future. And Jesus shows us that the way the story reads today is not necessarily how it's going to read in the future. So, like, we can ask ourselves, like, do I have an eternal perspective and the simple things that we do every day? I'm not talking about, like, just being so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good, you know. But as a mom and dad, do you have an eternal perspective of being a parent? I know, like, it's really hard when they're little. It doesn't get easier when they become teenagers. I just want to encourage all you parents of young kids that you have power over now, and soon you won't have any power at all. But you're going to spend a lot of money on them. We have to have an eternal perspective about, like, what are we affecting in their lives? If you're a plumber, and, you know, like, I've always heard plumbers do really well. We love plumbers. And a lot of, you know, like, you have jobs where you go in and it's like, it's a really easy job and, like, you get paid and it's like, that's awesome. And then other days, you're probably waiting in sewage. Do you have an eternal perspective when you're standing in the sewage? Because you can. It's no fun, but you're actually helping somebody in that moment. Or if you're a business owner, do you have eternal perspective when the thing you have to do isn't really penciling out? Like, it's a loser, but, like, the right thing to do is to stick with it and to follow through with that client, because that's going to have all kinds of ramifications in the future. That's an eternal perspective in your job. If you're an elected official and you're trying to do the right thing, you're trying to make your community better, but you're taking all this constant criticism from everybody that really just wants your job and they want to make you look bad, and that's really hard in that moment when you hold this position. You have an eternal perspective that why you're there in that position right now, to do good for your community or the organization that you're a part of. What about those of you who are investing in our children's ministry right now? And you're in there, and sometimes it hurts to get down on your knees with them. Some Sundays you really don't want to show up, but do you realize that the impact you're making on that child week after week, just in your consistency with them? Or what about the hardship that you're in right now? You got a tough decision ahead of you. There's a dilemma you have to solve. Can you have an eternal perspective about that? Can eternity guide that decision? How does thinking about the things that we have to do or to face, how does that change our perspective if we have an eternal perspective in it? Mary's worship looked like this extravagant waste to others in the room, but not to Jesus, because Mary saw the big picture. And she didn't know this, but her act was going to be recorded forever in the Bible. She had an eternal perspective. And a life guided by Jesus is guided by that perspective. Last, number four, the way of Jesus is a life of personal responsibility. Personal responsibility. John says that people decided for themselves about Jesus, verse 37. Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they still would not believe him. And others, we saw, believed, yet they would not openly acknowledge their faith for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. The truth is that nobody can believe for us. Nobody can choose for us to follow in the way of Jesus. And you know, the excuse of, I didn't have time to figure out what I believed, or I was afraid of what others would think, or I went along with everyone around me because it was easier, none of those will hold water in the end. Each of us is accountable for our response to the claims of Jesus. I'm going to ask the band to come up. We're accountable to not just that Jesus is the Son of God and he saves me. He holds us responsible personally to think critically about not just believing in Jesus, but the Jesus we actually believe in. And that's why John's gospel is so important. What we've been looking at, like, over these last, I think this is week 15, is who Jesus really was. We're looking at his life and the conversations that he had and the people that he responded to and the way he responded and the things that he did. And John said that he wrote his gospel so that you could believe. He's telling these stories, he's recounting the life of Jesus so that each of us can see who Jesus is and we can decide for ourselves. So if you're on the fence, I want to just like remind you that no one is guaranteed tomorrow. There's an urgency to believing and placing your faith in Jesus. And for those of us who have, John helps us to see, like, to kind of think critically about whether we're actually following the real Jesus. The one that invites us to worship him above all else. The one that leads us into a life of service. The one who invites us to think about the impact of our actions with a future view, an eternal perspective. And the one that we will ultimately stand before, personally responsible for the lives that we lived and the things that we did. Because after all, won't that be the room where it really happens? Yeah. Let's stand and pray, or sing.
Hey everybody, it's Britt again. Thanks for listening. If you need something, if you have a question, or you'd just like us to pray for you, you can reach us through email, info@sunridgechurch.org. We hope you'll listen in again next week, but in the meantime, keep helping people find and follow Jesus.